But we're in the middle of a lesson that's kind of digging into this parable. It's a parable of people who missed the life Jesus seemed to be talking about as the spiritual life. He called it the kingdom of God life. We recognize that in our culture, the word kingdom carries connotations of hierarchy and control that don't necessarily match the way Jesus talked about it. So in order to try and do a better translation last week, we talked about calling it the commonwealth of God. Or we could even think of it in terms, familial terms, the extended family of God. But the basic premise is this: the divine indwells you. And to be awakened to that interior presence is going to change how you live in the world and how you relate in the world. To be awakened to that interior presence is going to change the way that we relate to our own people. It's going to change how we relate to women, to Samaritans, to adulterers, Jesus showed us. It changes how we relate to unjust Roman oppressors. It changes the world we're willing to settle for. It changes the world that we're spending our lives contending to bring into being. And this kingdom, this commonwealth of the divine, Jesus said, you don't want to miss it. It's wonderful. And then he went on to say that some people miss it, the folks in this parable. And they didn't miss it because they were morally lax, or they didn't miss it because they were insufficiently devout. No, they missed it simply because they were in a hurry, because their lives were filled up with busyness. Practical people doing practical stuff, the kind of practical stuff that practical people do. Hurry, we've seen in this lesson, distracts us from the examined life. Hurry averts our attention. It causes us to see only the job, or only the household, or only the broken computer, or only the next deal that we're working on. And in so doing, we miss the divine life. We miss the divine presence that is always there available in the job and in the household and with the computer and in the deals that we make. And so what we've said is that hurry becomes toxic. Toxic hurry becomes the high price of the unexamined life. That's the title for this lesson that we're using to unpack Jesus' parable. So we've been spending some weeks talking about why the unhurried life happens to us. And so far, we've seen this. We've seen that it does indeed damage us, but despite the fact that it does, even so, as a culture, we just keep coming back to it. We just keep being drawn into hurry. It's like a moth being drawn to the flame. It happens to us, even though we look up and say, oh my God, my life is just going too crazy. I need to slow down. Nevertheless, you turn around, and the next thing, our instincts carry us to this dimension of hurry again. So, to help us in our blindness, in this lesson, we're talking about some of the whys behind why we get sucked back into this thing that we don't want to be sucked into. Forewarned is forearmed, I've said several times in this lesson. The first reason we looked at was the impact of a 19th century American philosophical school that has profoundly influenced the culture that we live in. We called it philosophical pragmatism. And we saw how that philosophy, when it runs unexamined in the background of our lives, leads us, it creates all these wonderful things for us, but it creates these two primal instincts that get us in so much trouble. And if you missed that, you can go online and have a listen. Today I want to talk about another current that runs unexamined in the background of our lives, that causes us to get swept up in this cultural craziness of the hurry. And it is how incredibly difficult it is for us to say no to something good. How incredibly difficult it is for us to say no to something good. A while ago, I did a lesson called The Suffocating Power of Stuff. And in it, we spoke about an economic shift that has happened in Western society since the late 50s and how that has profoundly affected our spirituality. It was the shift, I said, from capitalism to consumerism. You probably remember that. Adam Smith's concept of capitalism can be said in just a few words. Wealth of Nations is a great big book, but you can fit everything he said on a postcard. And here's basically the premise on a 3x5 card that would say this. If you want to live in a capitalistic society, your job is to find a need and then fill that need as efficiently and as inexpensively as possible. And if you do that, you are going to become unwittingly an agent of the most efficient distribution of resources within the society. You are going to find that you are helping meet the needs of the society, and you're going to find that you make a tidy profit in the process. So you learn how to be as efficient in creating things as possible, and you will be rewarded for it, as will the society. And the thing is, capitalism worked. It worked like a charm. In the 400, 500 years that it was the dominant culture in our, or was the dominant economic force in our culture, it transformed the Western world. So much so that by the time we got to the end of the Second World War, we had almost met all of the material needs that people had. Now, there's some very notable exceptions, pockets of poverty, but in America, it was one of the times of greatest prosperity for the largest number of people that had been seen before. So when that happened, and people's needs were in many ways met, it created a little bit of trouble for the first step in capitalism, which is find a need. And if the needs are met, what do you do? So we went through a fundamental shift in the way that we practice capitalism that has become the most seismic thing to happen globally, almost, that we can speak of. No longer do we find a need, now we create a need. We manufacture desire through vigorous marketing and advertising, and then we service the desire that we have created. Nobody needs $300 tennis shoes. And yet, we create a need for $300 tennis shoes, and then we service that need. And this shift in our society means that the best and the brightest among us are strategizing every day and every night, figuring out how to get us to want stuff, how to want a widget, or to want a lifestyle, or to want an electronic device. And they wouldn't be in business if they weren't good at it. I am counting down the days until I get my new phone. I have 10 more days and then I'm due. These guys have done their job on me. And so our economy runs on this premise: create a need and then manufacture a product or a service in order to service that need. That's what we talked about in that lesson, the suffocating power of stuff. Today I want to look at an unintended consequence that has come from this way of doing business, this economic system that we live under, and it is this: the tremendous proliferation of options. The tremendous proliferation of options. When you go to the grocery store to buy peanut butter now, you will find 40 distinct varieties. Not two, smooth and chunky, no. You will find 40 distinct products. In the first lesson, somebody came up and said, the guy from Kenya, he said, "I've only been here 10 years, and when we were living in Kenya, you had one peanut butter if you had any." And he said, "Now I'm coming here, and I'm realizing I did not know that I needed to have flaxseed in my peanut butter." Because now I can put it on my bread and take care of my omega-3 acids all at one time. Well, it turns out that when you create a need and then service it, one of the unintended byproducts is an explosion of these proliferation of options in our everyday life. When you go to the store to buy peanut butter now, what you have to do is you have to reject 39 options to come home with one. And it turns out that the rejecting of 39 options doesn't work very well in the human brain. We all think that we like having variety. We all think that we like having options, but it turns out at some deep level, part of us doesn't like that. Too many options leads to what marketers call the paradox of choice. On the one hand, more choices makes us feel like we go home with a superior product because we chose from a whole bunch of things. But on the other hand, people who study us buying stuff, and there's a lot of people out studying how we buy stuff, talk about shopping paralysis. With so many options, we worry that we'll make the wrong choice. We worry that we'll do something and later on we will regret it. We will have put our resources toward this thing and regret having done so. We'll make a mistake and we don't want to. We don't want to feel stupid. We don't want to think that we missed something good. We don't want to think that we've muddled this thing up. And so, having greater variety actually increases a level of anxiety among us in our culture. Now, some marketers are getting savvy to this human dilemma. Not many of them, but some of them. I read an article on why Trader Joe's is doing so well, carving out a niche in this very competitive retail market. There's a lot of reasons why they do it, but one of them is that they don't offer that many choices. They develop an expectation that their products will be of the highest quality. And so if you go look at peanut butter at Trader Joe's, what you're going to find is not 40 options, but you're going to find 10. And it turns out that customers who buy one jar of peanut butter at Trader Joe's walk away more satisfied with Trader Joe's organic, creamy, unsalted peanut butter than they would have having had to reject only 9 options instead of having to reject 39 options. They have a better feeling about that. And having a better feeling about it creates that thing that marketers want to get, a good feel when you walk out, and so consequently people come back. And when they come back, this has been part of their strategy for having their great success. Well, we're not a trade organization, so we're a spiritual community. What does any of that have to do with the examined life? Well, here's the thing you need to know about the world that you live in. Trader Joe's approach is rare. Cell phone plans are notorious for option giving. It's almost like you need a degree to go in and get a cell phone plan. Television is the same. It used to be that A&E and TNT just replayed content from some other provider, but now they're generating their own content, and it's really good content. And you take that and multiply it by 250 channels that most people get, and you realize you can no longer watch all the TV programs that are good. There are too many of them. It's very difficult to go out and get the best widget, whether it's a tablet or whether it's a phone or whatever it is, because now each one of them all has, there's 7 different varieties, all of them that have certain features that are best, and you can't get best anymore. Parents face incredible social pressure to expose their children to all the possible options for growth, all the possible options for betterment. So you've got dance lessons, and you've got music lessons, and you've got soccer league, and you've got little league, and you've got scouts, and you've got princesses. And when they get to high school, they need to take all the AP courses that their high school offers so that they can get into the school that they really want to get into. And the resume needs to have a sport on it. It needs to have community service on it. And it needs to have grades on it. And each one of those things takes up an evening or takes up a Saturday. And not a single one of these things is bad. They're all good. They're all very, very good. The problem is, in aggregate, they become bad. When you put them all together, that's too much good. And that becomes the trap to our souls. When we have not built into our lives intentional examination, we get sucked into saying yes to more good things than our bodies can handle, more good things than our minds can do. I was reading a book about on simplicity a while ago. The author was a Buddhist, and he was in Tibet somewhere, and he was writing this book there, and he was looking from his place out on this pastoral scene of great peacefulness. And he said, here is this life that people live with enough to do and enough time to do it, something that most Westerners who are driven to frenzy would be jealous of. And then he said, but when I look over there toward the homes, what I see is something new that wasn't here 10 years ago. I see satellite dishes on top of every one of their houses, which means they will be facing the same kind of struggle we're facing in just a short amount of time. And so he said, we can't go back in order to find the unhurried life because we're not going to an option-free world. It just isn't going to happen. We have to go forward. We can't look backwards to the golden day when things were simple, because in the golden day when options weren't available, medical options weren't available. It means you were going to die earlier. We're not going back. What we have to do is go forward, which means that this is a time in history like no other time before. This proliferation of options is not going away. We're going to have to learn how to handle it, which means we're going to have to develop something inside of ourselves that other generations before us never had to develop inside of ourselves. We're going to have to exercise the capacity for no saying. All right. We fill up our days with good things, and when we do it, We have this unfiltered process by which we make the approval. This is a good thing, we say to ourselves. And because it's a good thing, I will say yes to it. And it is a good thing is all the filtering that we say, and then we take it into our lives. And consequently, we end up doing way too many things. Our lives become lives of hurry, the toxic hurry that we're talking about. As I've said many times, and I've taught my kids when we were growing up, every yes is a no. When we say yes to one option, it says no to something else. We say yes to this, it's going to cost us something. It's going to cost us hours that we have to work in order to pay for this new widget that we buy. It's going to cost us mind space in order to process this thing. It's going to cost us hours on our calendar. It's going to cost us paperwork to keep up with it. Every yes is a no. Costing us time that we could have spent looking at the fireplace. Costing us time that we could have spent with nothing of a to-do list plaguing our brains. It could have cost us unstructured time with a loved one just to see what happens. When we say yes, it costs us sex, and it costs us a leisurely meal, and it costs us energy, and it costs us fatigue. We say yes to computers with features that we don't use but think perhaps one day we might, and so we pay a little extra, and then we have to work the hours in order to pay that extra. We get a warranty on the camera that doesn't make financial sense, but it might break later, and we want to cover our options and say yes to everything, and so in the process we do, but we have to pay for that. We give up time in order to have these things. We give up mental space in order to have these things. We give up relational time in order to have these things. So when ours is an unfiltered, unexamined acceptance of the things that these marketing geniuses want to tell us we want, we do tend to fall victim to toxic hurry, and our souls suffer. When we offer our children a wide range of skills by offering them a wide range of activities, we are saying no to them becoming really good at one thing by focusing on it. We are saying no to the time and space for them to be thinking creatively. We are saying no to a life with enough to do and enough time to do it. When our unfiltered yeses to all the good things that life presents to us, when we bring possessions into our sphere and we bring activities into our sphere, when we bring job promotions into our spheres without ever questioning and examining whether this job promotion is good for me, when we bring purchases and hobbies into our lives, we end up running at a faster pace in order to service them. We run back and forth between things that are good, maybe even important things, but most of the time we don't see the things that get left behind. And for many, if not most, this is a fool's game. But it's a fool's game that you and I are very good at playing, because this is the culture we live in. This is the air that we breathe. This is the water we drink. The world that you and I live in is very different than the world of our grandparents or our great-grandparents. Ours is not a world with a lack of opportunity as theirs was. Their world had limited options, limited possibilities, limited opportunities. Ours, on the other hand, is a world with a dizzying abundance of opportunities. Now, in historical terms, this is a relatively recent phenomenon. Our no-saying skills haven't caught up to the world as the world is. There are now so many options that didn't exist even 100 years ago, 50 years ago, 25 years ago, that our capacity to filter and say no hasn't caught up to this new world that we live in. So we are being marketed the message, you can have it all, as though we still lived in the world when we couldn't. Of course we can have it all. Now the question is, how can I have peace as well? How can I have an interior life that makes sense as well? Our world is telling our young people that they have to develop themselves in every possible way if they want to get onto the track that's going to lead them to the good life. They have to taste every aspect of life. They have to be sure that they do these 1,000 things before they die. But this approach to living doesn't take into account the limits of human being. Because human being is boxed into a reality in which there are only 24 hours in a day. in which we need to sleep 8 hours a night, where children are only home for 18 years, where there are only 40 years in a career, where everybody only gets X number of energy units. So we hurry and we try and exceed those limits because we are afraid that we might miss something good that life has to offer us. We carry around this low-grade satisfaction that we might have bought the wrong peanut butter or the wrong tablet or signed for 2 years with the wrong cell phone plan. And we worry that our kids won't get everything that this short stint that they have on the planet has to offer them, that they might miss some of life's gusto. So we say yes. And when we do say yes, beyond the limits of our bodies and beyond the limits of our minds and beyond the limits of what relationships can sustain and beyond the limits of what is good for our souls, we do so at our peril. So there you are, forewarned, let's be forearmed. This is what Jesus was talking about in this parable that we're looking at. And this is what your brain will do to you if you don't watch over your brain. And this is what your society will do to you if you don't live the examined life. And this is what will happen to you if you just go with the flow and if you don't watch diligently. Last fall, the book club read Predictably Irrational. In it, the author talked about an experiment that was run at MIT along these lines. They rigged a computer game with three doors on it and gave people 100 clicks, and each click generated some random amount of money, some number of pennies. And in their 100 clicks, the objective of the game was to accumulate as much money as they could possibly by figuring out where the greater pay per click happened. The gamers tried all three doors. When this experiment was set up, they quickly figured out which door paid the highest. The numbers were all random, but one of them tended to pay more, and they figured out which one it was, and they clicked on that until they had finished their 100 clicks, and they accumulated usually the most of money that could be accumulated, because they're sensible kids after all. This is MIT. They were bright. But then they got decidedly unbright when they changed the experiment. And this time, every time they clicked on one door, the other two doors diminished in size by a 12th. And so that after 12 clicks, those doors were gone. Well, when that happened, the subjects began to do some crazy stuff. When it didn't matter which door yielded more cents per click, that went out of their minds. They were consumed with not losing the option that was behind other doors. Listen to how the experimenter described one of the subjects. Sam was our first participant in the disappearing door condition. He chose the blue door, entered, and clicked three times. His earnings built up at the bottom of the screen, but his eyes saw that with each additional click, the other doors diminished by a 12th, 8 more clicks, and they would disappear forever. Not about to let that happen, he swung his cursor around and clicked the red door, bringing it back to full size. Clicking three times inside the red door, the green door was 4 clicks away from disappearing. Once again, he moved his cursor to restore the green door, and the green door began delivering the highest payout. But would he stay there? Remember that each room had a range of payouts, so he couldn't be completely convinced that the green door was actually the best, but indications were that it was. With a frenzied look in his eye, Sam swung his cursor around to the screen. He clicked on the red door and watched the blue door continue to shrink. After a few clicks in the red, he jumped over to the blue, but by now the green door was beginning to get dangerously small, and thence he was back there again to the next. Before long, Sam was racing from one option to another, his body leaning tensely into the game, and I found this line to be most descriptive, most telling. He said, "In my mind, as I watched Sam, I pictured a typically harried parent rushing kids from one activity to the next." Now, the author calls that an irrational life. But for so many of us, it is simply the natural outcome of the unexamined life, the unfiltered life. It is, in fact, the American life. Running from good thing to good thing is not an effective way to live. The cost that it exacts of us is rarely worth the benefit of the option that we might have gotten had we chased it down. Running pillar to post is the antithesis of the examined life, the antithesis of the filter that helps us decide our yeses and our noes. Now, in the MIT experiment, most of the kids ran pillar to post. And the ones that did ended up making about 15% less money than those who did not. When the game's code was exposed, one of the doors was indeed better than the others, but anybody who chose any one of the doors and stayed with it would do better than those who jumped from door to door and lost the 15%. That was a game. But in life, the consequences are different. In life, we are beset with tragedy if we don't see how the marketing engine that drives our nation affects our day-to-day decisions. If we don't see what is just being bred into our instincts that we bring to our day-to-day life that we are driven by, if we don't see those things and if we can't respond to them, the consequences are tragic. We make choices that demand that we work more hours at our jobs, but fail to realize that our children's childhood is slipping away. Some doors close so slowly you don't see it happening. We make choices that fill up our hours, we give away our energy units, and our choice gives us a small return because these were good choices. But what we exchanged for it was something that had greater significance, something like tending to our soul, or tending to our relationships, or tending to our minds, or even tending to our bodies. The unexamined life is a punishing life. And one of those punishments is toxic hurry. We lose what matters in lieu of what is only good. And seasons of reflection become imperative in the culture we live in. From the time of the ancients, we have been being told that seasons of reflection were important. But I think we have come upon a time in human history when seasons of reflection become survival strategies. We won't make the transition before us if we don't learn, examine. Because these seasons act as an alarm for us, a corrective for us, warning us that really good things are slipping away while we are saying yes to less important things. One of the ladies in our community told me a story this week about her life. She's been practicing examine of consciousness since I talked about it last December, and each night she asks herself the four questions and she spends some time writing on there. By the way, if you missed that, if you just go to our audio site and put in the word examine, it's Latin word E-X-A-M-E-N, it'll bring up the audio file, but it'll also bring up a bookmark that'll help guide you through it. Well, anyway, she had her notebook with her when we spoke. She writes it, and I do it on a computer when I do it, but she had her notebook, and she was looking through it, and she was saying, "You will not believe the week that I have had, Doug." She said, "I got myself wrapped around the axle trying to do research on buying this $30 electronic thing that I wanted to buy. And I am a researcher, and boy, did I spend the week researching. I just couldn't stop. I was just going after it. I was looking at all the reviews that everybody had to say about this and everybody had to say about that. And over the week, I lost a tremendous amount of peace. Over the week, this time that I had. I was so anxious. I was so stressed. And I was all over a stupid $30. And while I was doing it, I was not only stressed because I wasn't finding out the right $30 thing, but I was also stressed that I was spending so much time stressing over this $30 thing, and I was just wrapped myself around this axle so much that it was just a horrible work, and I just am such a terrible spiritual person. I have just lost the spiritual life. I am just a real loser when it comes to this, and here I am, Doug. Blah." And she said, "If you look through my examine of consciousness journal, it's just testimony to one big failure after another. Look at that." And I said, "Failure? Really?" I said, "I don't know how many days ago that happened, but look at the awareness that you bring to the explanation that you have to me that you would not have had you not done this process of examine. Because what I see is I no longer see you combined there with that impulse, but I see you standing outside of that impulse, and I see you critiquing it and observing it and watching it." And I said, "That is a critical step in the process of spiritual awareness. In these X number of days since you got wrapped around the axle, your awareness of what has gone has been greatly enhanced. And as a result, you've now seen what you do And now you and I can together laugh about it. And we can say, oh, look at me doing that crazy thing that I do. And that means that you're going to be much more likely to say no much sooner the next time around. You're going to see yourself doing this thing much earlier next time around. You're going to laugh at yourself without me being here to laugh with you, because you will be feeling those feelings, and yet you will be watching yourself feeling those feelings. That's what the examined life does. It doesn't save us from mistakes that we make as much as it makes us aware of the mistakes that we make. Because most of the time we go through our days and we live them, and at the end of the day we go to bed and get up the next day and do it all again, not even having been aware of what we had done. And the seeing, well, that's what helps us live the filtered life. The examination that brings us, helps us to say yes more circumspectly and helps us to say no more appropriately. Well, Jesus said they missed the kingdom of God, they missed the commonwealth of God because their lives were in a hurry. So we've talked about hurry that comes from philosophical pragmatism. We've talked about hurry that comes from our difficulty saying no to the good. Next week we'll talk about another thing that causes us to hurry, and then we'll start talking about how to repair the damage. So Holy Spirit, living in the world of marketing geniuses as we do, living in the world of fear that we might miss all of the gusto that life has to offer, we are so prone to the anxiety about loss, to the paralysis of choice. We try our best and we say yes to more things than we can sustain in our lives. So help us. Interior divine presence, alert us. Open the eyes of our souls, that we may access the wisdom that is within us, because the Spirit of God is within us. Be that so, Lord. In Jesus' name, amen.